Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 26, 2016, and this is show number 581. Well, I'm a huge fan of Bart's show, Let's Talk Photography. Once a month, he comes out with a show with one or more other photographers, not to argue about, like, well, is Canon or Nikon better, but to talk about techniques, ideas for new photography projects, how to get your photos printed, and more. Last month, on episode 32, he was joined by Antonio Rosario of the Street Shots podcast, another favorite show of mine. In that episode, they went through the subject of adjustments in imaging image editing software. It was great because while their discussion used mostly examples from Lightroom and Photoshop, you're able to learn what all these different adjustments mean, and that's pretty transportable information between image editors, so it applies to me and my favorite Affinity photo editor. However, as I listened, it opened up more questions. For example, they talked about vibrance and saturation. Well, both seem to intensify the colors, but why would you pick one over the other? And how about this whole idea of sharpening an image? What's the difference between sharpen, unmask, clarity, definition, and structure? The more I thought about those questions, the more questions I had. I was in the middle of planning out my Affinity Photo video tutorial for Screencast Online, and I was trying to figure out the fundamental difference between brightness, exposure, white point and black point sliders, histogram points and curves. They all seem kind of like the same thing, so why would I use one over the other, and why are they all there? As I often do, I wrote a note to the podcasters. I do this all the time with all the podcasts I listen to. In this case, to Bart and Antonio, and I asked them all these questions. Bart was happy to get the email because he hadn't yet thought of a topic for episode 33, and this sounded perfect. But instead of Antonio and him just answering my questions on the air, he invited me to come on the show to ask the questions myself. I had a great time. It was like being a student in class and having one-on-one access to the teacher's brain all to myself. The best part of the show is that often one of them answers my question, and then the other one says, well, that's not exactly right. It was fun to hear them argue, and I learned even more when they did argue. Bart's skill with the tools is phenomenal, and Antonio's knowledge of how these tools came out of the film era and progressed through the years in image editors is it's a perfect complement to have both of their perspectives. A lot of times it was knowledge that Antonio had from the way the film era worked in order to understand why those tools existed today and how they did work. The two of them went back and forth and learned from each other while teaching me what I wanted to know. I'm not going to tell you any of the answers to the questions. Instead, you can go listen at let's-talk.ie and look for episode 33 of the Let's Talk Photography podcast. The only bummer for me is that now I don't have an episode of the show to listen to this month, but you do. Well, in Chit Chat Across the Pond this week, Bart is back with Programming by Stealth, Lesson 17, where we get into JavaScript objects. This was a bit of a brain twister for me, but Bart's excellent explanations finally drilled most of it home to me, I think. I was also very proud of my little self for getting an A- on my homework from the previous episode. It was structurally and logically completely correct, and I only lost points because I forgot to indent one function line, sort of like misspelling your name or the teacher's name on the top of your paper. I have to admit that I had a lot of help from my teaching assistant, Alistair Jenks, though. I can't take full credit for getting an A-. It was really great, though, to have Alistair explain the same things Bart has explained to me, but from a different angle. It really helped me cement some of the more obscure concepts into my brain, like anonymous functions. Now, I got to tell you, sometimes when I'm working on this stuff, when I'm working on the homework, I hear myself saying, this is too hard. I totally don't understand. I'm never going to get this. What I've tried to do is replace those negative thoughts with Professor Marianne Gary telling us that the way to keep our brains in good health is we need to find things that are difficult for us and to master them. Programming is what I've chosen to try to stay mentally fit. I've been using iThoughts X, the awesome mind mapping software from Toketaware.com, to map out how to attack the video screencasts I do for Don McAllister's Screencasts Online. It really helps me when I'm figuring out my plan of attack to just throw a bunch of disorganized bubbles all over the screen as I think up different things I want to teach about an application. After it becomes enough of a mess, I start dragging the bubbles around to lump them together and try to make a cohesive story for the tutorial. As I record each bit of the tutorial, I pause and color code the appropriate bubbles to mark them complete and then close up the branches so it's easier to focus and be able to tell what I've finished. I thought I had the perfect workflow going until I saw David Sparks talking at Macworld a few years ago explaining his workflow for writing books. Like my process, he starts with a mind map, but then he takes an interesting turn. He exports his mind maps using the OPML format. That stands for Outline Processor Markup Language, and it's basically an outlining language. He then pulls that OPML file into Omni Outliner from the Omni Group over at omnigroup.com. He even showed how he can round-trip his thoughts, exporting again in OPML and then back into his mind mapping tool. So you can actually go back and forth between outlines and mind maps using OPML. Now, I had no idea you could pass mind maps to outlining programs and back using OPML until David explained that on stage. This got me to thinking maybe this kind of workflow would help me in planning my tutorials. While bubbles are ideal for dragging around to organize bursts of ideas, they're limited in how much you can write and also to keep the mind map manageable. I'm sure Omni Outliner is a terrific program, but I don't need a lot of crazy awesome features in an outlining application. At $50 for the non-pro Mac App Store version, it's too expensive for my very limited needs. I'm not writing a complex novel, I'm outlining a 45-minute video. I went on a hunt for a tool that would fit my needs, and after trying some pretty janky free outlining programs, some of them were horrible, I found the right one for me that was not free. It's called Tree from topoftree.jp. It's only $12 in the Mac App Store, which for me hits the sweet spot between freeware, jankiness, and real money, high-end applications. Tree is so named because it has two different views. It has the traditional outline view where child items are indented under their parent, and then it has this tree style view where the child items are in columns to the right of their parents. Personally, I make too many sublevels in my outlines to make the tree style view practical, so it just starts kind of flowing off the right-hand side of the screen, but maybe that's a view that will help others. I think my favorite thing about working in Tree is that it's so fast to write an outline using keystrokes you already know. Type a line, hit enter, makes a new item. If you want the next item to be a child item, you can hit Command K. Want the next line indented? Hit Tab. Oops, want it back out a level? Command Shift Tab to bring it back out. I won't go through all of these options, but just about everything you'd want to do is available as a keystroke. If you dislike using keystrokes, there's big bold buttons for add item, add child, indent, outdent, and even delete items. There are also buttons to add labels to items, which changes their bullet color, and buttons to change the color and font of the text. Once an item has at least one child, the bullet changes to a disclosure triangle, allowing you to hide and reveal those child items. Tree also allows you to drag and drop items to move them around, and I do that a lot when I'm organizing my thoughts. It's almost as easy as dragging bubbles in iThoughts. You can toggle on-off checkboxes for the entire outline, and then check items off after you've dealt with them. I tend to need something a bit more visually obvious, though, than the light gray checkboxes in Tree, so I just changed the entire line of text to a new color instead. I was thinking about it while I was writing this up, and I think I might just start making lines bold when I'm done, because that stands out just as well as color, but it's easier to do with a keystroke than changing the color with a physical button, that you have to go through menus. Label colors are easy too, but just like the checkboxes, having that teeny bullet or disclosure triangle change color isn't obvious enough for me. I kind of wish it just changed the color of the whole line. The one thing I do wish was easier in Tree is how to select an entire family, so the parent and the children, so that I could mark the entire thing as complete. It might be in there somewhere, but I haven't found out how to do it yet. Now, it's not that hard to do a shift select, but everything else is so intuitive, I keep thinking maybe there's an easier way, like triple-clicking on the parent or something like that. If your outline is getting complex and you want to focus on one section, you can open a family in a new tab. You can do this through the menus or with Command-Shift-O. This lets you work in a clean area with lots of room, and when you close the tab, any changes you made are reflected in the main document. If you close the main document, the family tab will close as well, and when you reopen the main document, it remembers to open both tabs. Very cool way to stay organized and simplify your view at the same time. My most recent video for Don is on Affinity Photo, like I mentioned earlier, and it's such a complex application that I really had to be organized to be able to fit it in 45 minutes. I decided to work in Tree this time, and it definitely helped. My notes, when exported to a rich text document, are 11 pages long. I'm afraid Tree may have created a monster. But using Tree, I was able to put in more information so I could glance over a Tree and back at Affinity Photo and keep recording the tutorial, and I'd actually have the text of what it was I meant to say. I'll always use a combination of iThoughts mind maps and tree outlines from now on for my video tutorials. For grins and giggles, I sent my outline from Tree back to iThoughts and took a screenshot in both applications of just one small section of the tutorial so you can see the same information in the two forms. That's, of course, in the show notes. Throwing ideas up into bubbles in iThoughts is still easier for me, especially since it runs on iOS and OS X, or do I say Mac OS now, so I always have a device with me where I can throw in ideas. That'll happen to me a lot of times. I'm at the grocery store. Well, let's not lie. I don't grocery shop, but I could be at the gym and I'll think up something and I can throw in an idea in my mind map and it's reflected on all my devices. But after doing the final organization and fleshing out my thoughts in Tree, it was much easier to stay on task while making my video. I should mention that I've been using Tree 1. I'm at version 1.97, and I just discovered that Tree 2 is already out. But I read the feature list and I couldn't find any significant differences, so hopefully this review will have given you an idea of what Tree 2 can do as well. I really think Tree, from topoftree.jp, and also available in the Mac App Store for, it's like $11 or $12, maybe it was $11.99, I think it hits the perfect sweet spot of light and easy, along with just enough capability to help me work quickly when organizing my thoughts. I'm sure you've heard me mention a few hundred times that we have a fabulous Google Plus community at podfeet.com/Google Plus, and we have an equally interesting Facebook group over at podfeet.com/Facebook. We have both of them, so you get to choose where you want to play. We're not going to take sides. Well, there's so many reasons to love these communities, not the least of which for me is that you guys can go in there and solve each other's problems. I love to help people, but having more people answering questions is always better. The other thing that's great is that sometimes someone asks a question, dumb or otherwise, and we discover that lots of us have the same problem to be solved. Let me give you a great example from this week. Alistair Jenks posted this question. Any suggestions for a very simple notepad for Mac OS, which launches quickly, with an open window document? I want somewhere where I can quickly paste in some text for reference, but I rarely want to keep it. TextEdit keeps asking me to create new documents, and the default view is too small. Ideally, I should be able to set a monospace font and choose foreground and background colors and size, and it should remember those. Any more than that is overkill. Well, immediately a whole bunch of people jumped in with, I have the same question. And I was one of those people who piled on with the same question. It irritates the daylights out of me that TextEdit doesn't open with a blank page. And I hate the spelling of TextEdit, because I use Spotlight to launch apps, and it always gets confused because the first five letters are the same between TextEdit and TextExpander. I just as soon never use TextEdit just because of the name. Well, Nightwise jumped into the discussion and suggested the text editor Atom, and that's one that Bart and I have talked a lot about on the show for programming. I'm not sure that one fits the requirement, though, because it has a tendency to open with the last thing you were working on. A handy feature for sure, but we're looking for something we can launch and hit post and not save. Kenneth Taylor jumped in with the suggestion of NVAlt from Brett Terpstra. I haven't used NVAlt in ages, so I fired it back up. NVAlt is a spinoff of Notational Velocity. It's a really sweet tool that lets you save notes that sync flawlessly and always have between your devices. One of its most powerful features is search, which is oddly in the same place where you type the title of new notes. Brett has really been bringing it into the fold for Markdown fanatics, so that's cool too. However, it doesn't meet this very niche need that many of us have. Just open in a blank screen so I can paste and be able to see what I pasted in a format of my choosing, or of Alistair's choosing. I'm glad Kenneth reminded us about NVAlt, though. It's back in the rotation of my useful apps. George from Tulsa suggested an app called TexEdit, that's T-E-X-Edit, from TransText Software. He explained that it's highly scriptable with an interface to Automator. It looks like this one hasn't been updated in a while, though, with the last full release being talking about Yosemite. It's worth a look if you've got $15 for shareware and you're looking for a scriptable text editor. Rob Raitt suggested a very simple 99-cent Mac App Store app called Notepad. This looks so beautifully simple, I thought it was going to meet all of Alistair's requirements. While you can change the font to what you want, it sadly doesn't remember that choice for new documents. Now, Alistair is terribly clever and figured out how to launch a saved document from within Alfred, and that has his settings set, but I'm not sure I want to go that far for this task. Well, Trevor Drover won this small but evidently important challenge, at least in my opinion. He suggested Coat Editor, I'm not quite sure whether it's code editor, COD editor. We'll go with COD editor. C-O-T-E-D-I-T-O-R. COD editor, and it's available for free in the Mac App Store. On first launch, it opened in a blank window. Yay, our first criteria is finally met. I do not know why that was so hard. Well, next up is being able to control the font and background colors. A quick trip to COD Edit Preferences shows a plethora of settings that are actually very easy to follow. In my experience, applications like Atom, the preferences are arcane and not very clear. The COD editor is laid out really well and very clear. For example, under Appearance, you can set the default font size and color, the line height, and whether to highlight the current line. You could choose from a variety of built-in themes, change the default colors of those themes, or even create your own themes. Everything Alistair could want. Before I go on with what else I feel I like about COD Editor, note that all of Alistair's original requirements have been soundly met. Now, he did say that anything else was would be overkill, but that's his problem. This is working for me with all this other stuff. In Atom, I finally had to call Bart to find out how the heck to get it to recognize that I was writing JavaScript and so do the correct syntax highlighting for me. Instead of in Preferences or in one of the menus, it was down in the bottom right of the window, which is well known as the graveyard of visual clues. In COD Editor, there's a super obvious pull-down in the top of every window that says Syntax Style. Even better, under the Format tab in Preferences, I found a default syntax style section where I could change it to JavaScript, so everything I do will open in JavaScript because that's all I'm doing from now on. By the way, if you don't want COD Editor to open a new window on launch, you can disable that in Preferences. You can choose Autosave with Versioning, which is I know a lot of you like, although I think it makes us weak and we got to learn to save. Anyway, here's another cool option in Prefs. Let's say I get all excited about using COD Editor and I have a document open. But let's say tomorrow I edit that same document in Atom and I hit save over in Atom. By default, COD Editor will automatically update the already open document to the modified version. I tested this and it works. This is really crazy. I've never seen that in any other app before. Maybe it's out there, but I've never seen it. You've also got options for word and character count. You can set default window sizes and transparency of the window, which I find annoying at best, but if you like that kind of thing, you can do it. In learning JavaScript, one of the things I really liked about Atom was that it would autocomplete standard syntax terms. That was terrific. And then over time, I realized that if I made a typo, like once I wrote NaN, which means not a number, I wrote it capital N, lowercase a, lowercase n. It should be capital N, lowercase a, capital N. And unfortunately, Atom remembered it and it kept offering it to me. So I've used it accidentally. It's like it lets you reuse your typos, which is the worst idea. In COD Editor, I can tell it to give me a completion list that includes words defined in my chosen syntax style, but not to include words just because they're in the document. That's going to help me out a lot. COD Editor lets you choose to invoke the word suggestions manually with escape, or you can have it suggest completions while typing. In this week's Programming by Stealth episode, Bart explained that whenever he creates a new function, he has a standardized set of comments that he puts in that he's forced up front to describe to his future self the purpose, the returns, and the arguments. I created a text expander snippet for this, and I plan to use it, but COD Editor has a built-in snippet tool that might be even better. You define a snippet of text and then a keystroke to invoke it. Works like a charm and might be better than gumming up your text expander snippet library with stuff for programming. But on the other hand, that's not transportable to other editors, so use that with caution. In Atom, I really like that if I type an open parenthesis or an open squiggly bracket, it adds the second one, so I can't possibly forget to close off my statements. Not that I don't still close them incorrectly, but it's nice to at least have that one safety net. That feature seemed to be missing in COD Editor, but I found a place to turn it on in the Edit Preferences. Another thing I like in Atom is that when you put your cursor next to a bracket of any kind, it highlights the matching one. In COD Editor, it seems to do it sometimes, but I haven't yet found the pattern of when it's showing it to me. I'm sure I'll get it sorted, but if someone else, maybe Trevor, has cracked the code on that, all puns intended, I'd really appreciate some guidance. The only thing I could find not to like in COD Editor, remember it's free, is that to open a new document, you use F5 instead of Command 0. I don't know why some tools use F5. It drives me crazy. Why aren't they all Command O? I should say, not Command 0, Command O. In preferences for Cut Editor, there's a section called Key Bindings, and I can see File Open, and I can tell it to use Command O, but hitting the keystroke doesn't do anything after I set it. When I quit and reopen Cut Editor, the change I made to the key binding has disappeared. According to the help file, you can't reuse a key binding, but I searched all of the menus and I didn't see one that was Command O, so I'm not sure what's going on for me. After I posted this as a blog post, Trevor said it is working for him. So there must be something happening. He thinks maybe I have another application that's using up Command O, but how do I figure out which one that is? That's going to be kind of hard. Well, anyway, the subject of this story was the wisdom of crowds. Through our fantastic audience, we got a lot of great suggestions to a problem many of us had. If you're not yet a member of one of the two groups, I can highly suggest joining either the Facebook group or the Google Plus community to find the help you need. Many thanks to all the people who are already in the groups, already contributing questions and answers. Let's keep that up. Well, it's that time of the weekend again. It is time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. How are we today, Bart?
I am doing just fine.
We should probably check in on your exercise streak. You've been riding your bike like a maniac and making those little circles go around on your watch like 11 times.
Yes, I got home about 20 minutes ago. No, about half an hour ago when I got home. It said tap, tap, look down. Congratulations. Longest move streak, 80 days.
80 days. That's insane. Now, and as we would like to recall, you're not doing 200 calories a day either.
No, I'm doing 1,000. Now, I've drawn a line under it. I'm not letting the watch push me beyond 1,000 a day as a goal. I'm completely trashing that goal a lot of days, but it's not realistic to go higher at a sustainable level because the Irish weather doesn't allow more than 1,000 calories a day every day.
Well, I was going to say, isn't the real news story that you've been able to go outdoors on a bicycle for 80 straight days in Ireland?
Yeah, that has involved, I believe yesterday, I didn't get home until nearly midnight because the weather was so rubbish up until about 10 p.m. So, you know, it's involved being a little bit creative.
But wow. Yeah. Now, are you riding in the dark at 10 o'clock at night or is it still light there?
It's still light because I'm at 50 something degrees north.
Oh, wow.
So light, given value of light.
Right.
Not dark.
Well, I was surprised when we went out at 8 o'clock last night and just going, well, so it's like broad daylight out here still. Always amazes me every year. It's a mystery.
But the solstice is not that long ago.
It was actually the day after the solstice that I noticed this, so.
Yeah, this is as long as it gets.
Yeah. That's why we're fat in the winter.
Well, it certainly works like that for me because the inverse, right? So right now we get it to be daylight until basically midnight or dusk until midnight anyway. But we pay a price for that in December when it's dark at 4:30.
Ugh.
So, you know, you win some, you lose some. So it's all sort of balances out.
There you go. Hey, I meant to ask you about this before just blindsiding you here, but do we want to talk at all about, or can I get you to describe in layman's terms what this differential privacy thing is that Apple announced?
It's in the show notes. So
oh, yes. It is. Excellent.
Okay. It's the top of suggested reading, but we'll dive in.
Yeah, I think people like to hear your perspective on what it is and what it means. I've done some reading on it, so I have a bit of an understanding, but I think it'd be fun to talk about.
No, yeah, so I will make a mental note that when we get to that in suggested reading, we'll do what we don't normally do and dig in.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess we should start with the important security updates. So Patch Tuesday has been and gone for June. That included a fix to a bug that has been nicknamed Bad Tunnel, and it goes back to all versions of Windows, back to and including Windows 95, hence including Windows XP, which is not getting patched.
Oh, so everything but XP back to 95?
No, everything including XP, but the Microsoft only patch the stuff that's in support.
Oh, okay. So 95 and XP have that bug, but it's not getting fixed.
95 has that bug, 98 has that bug, ME has that bug, XP has that bug,
2000 probably?
Windows has it, probably does.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those are getting patched. So the first one to get patched is Windows. I think Vista is still just about in support.
Yikes.
Just about. And then 7 is definitely still in support until 2019. Obviously, 8 and 10 are still in support. So yeah, I think it's about time we can declare XP dead now.
Or at least unplugged from the network.
At least unplugged from the network. Absolutely, at least unplugged from the network. Yeah, I mean, it's come on. I mean, Windows 7 is a fine OS. If you're going to be a Luddite, Windows 7 is okay. Adobe released a bunch of patches on Patch Tuesday to Creative Cloud Brackets, which is their free text editor. It's quite like Atom, actually. Brackets is quite nice. Huh. Cold Fusion and DNG DevKit. And they said, there is a really nasty problem in Flash. There's a zero-day exploit out there. It's being exploited in the world, but we're not ready. So stay tuned. We'll get it to you ASAP. And then a few days later, they did.
Oh, they did. Good. Oh,
so there is an out-of-band... So it's out-of-band by like 3 days. I think it took them 3 days to get that patch ready to roll out. So there is a very important Flash update. And all of the browsers did their usual trick, if you didn't update, of just blocking Flash with a little warning saying, this Flash is out of date and highly dangerous. Update it now. Paraphrasing a little bit, but that's basically... I had Firefox tell me that it was disabling Flash until I updated. Apple also released an update, a security update, and I think it was just the last time we spoke, we said that there was an update to the AirPorts, but there was no need to panic about it from a security point of view. It was just a feature update. Well, now there's another update for your AirPort, and this one is most certainly a security update.
So when I saw this in the notes, I just had a little frown on my face. I thought, Bart, we talked about that last time, because I remember seeing a little amber blinking light on my AirPort, and I don't have an amber. Oh, look at that. My AirPort's blinking amber right now. I will do the update and remind my father-in-law to do as well.
There you go. So, yeah, it's in this case, it's a bug in how the AirPort deals with DNS responses. That's just bad, because anyone can trick you into making a DNS query to a malicious DNS server by sending you an email that includes a picture, or tweeting you a link that has a picture in it or whatever. Like, it's so easy to make your computer do a DNS lookup. And so that's the kind of bug that you need to have patched ASAP. So the update is there. It's blinking orange for a reason. Obey.
All right. I will. I had not noticed it. When did that come out?
The day before yesterday or so.
Wow.
Recently-ish. I don't know how often they check in. They may not check in daily. So your blinky light may not have started blinking the moment that Apple released the update.
Oh, okay.
It's only when your AirPort notices it's behind.
Yeah.
Because they don't reach in to tell you. Your AirPort reaches out to ask.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Like your Mac, you mean. So it just depends on how it's configured. I don't know off the top of my head whether it does it every 3 days, every day, every week. I know it does it at some stage because it pops up and says, hello, update me. Okay, so important security news. The first one is courtesy of a certain Alison Sheridan. you received this in your inbox. Netgear sent out an email to their customers warning of an as-yet unpatched vulnerability in a whole bunch of their routers. And they give some advice on how you protect yourself from this bug by turning on password recovery, which seems like a horrible thing to do.
But also making sure remote management is turned off.
Yes, which I should hope.
For some reason, the two of those... It is off by default, if you're wondering, because I did never turned it on and I checked and it was off, but I went ahead and turned on password recovery. It's kind of a weird little interface to do it, though, when you go into password recovery and you have to give it some answers to some security questions. So I let, I just use XKPassWD to come up with these crazy, garbage questions and garbage answers. Actually, I had to have their questions, my garbage answers. And after you do it, you go... apply, and the screen doesn't change. I'm like, well, apply, and nothing changes on screen. There's no visible that you've saved or anything. So I switch to another screen and I come back. It still says it's done. So I logged out, and then I tried to go back to 10.0.0.1, and it didn't make me log in again, even though I told it to log out. And that bothered me a little bit. I said, okay, well, let me open it up on another browser. I open it up, and it's still just sitting there with these answers sitting in the clear. Just sort of unsatisfying, that's all. Apparently it did it. It just didn't feel like it did it.
I this concept of having to set this recovery stuff, to me, that just makes your router less secure. So I think this is a terrible... I would never turn on a feature like that.
Like what? Like
unless
remote management?
The choice was... No, not remote management, the password recovery. I would never turn on such a feature unless my choice was be not horribly insecure or turn it on because of the bug.
So make sure I turn it off.
I would turn it off when they fix this. So there has not... you haven't got a follow-up email to say that there's a fix, I presume.
Not yet. I just got that yesterday, I think.
I think it was yesterday you forwarded it on to me, yeah. And they said something like within the next few weeks, I believe is how they phrased their timeline.
So, okay.
Yeah. Could be a while.
So it's good that they told us. Good that they had a temporary holding fix that wasn't difficult to do.
Yes. Yeah, no, this is responsible, right? And didn't Netgear get... Oh, no, it was ASUS who got a gigantic slap on the wrist for being bad about security, now that I think about it. Yeah. Although Netgear's record is... Anyway, I was just listening to Security Now, where they were describing some Netgear cameras with spectacular insecurities. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of Netgear, to be perfectly honest, but they do good engineering. So, on the one hand, they do lovely engineering. On the other hand, their security history is a bit...
Yeah.
So... But anyway, sorry, I don't want to put you off your router. It's a nice router.
It looks really cool.
Yes. And it has nice features and it does all, you know, the actual radio, you know, the RF, the being a router bit, it's pretty good at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, the next story makes me very sad. Twice. So we had, obviously, the tragic shooting in Orlando, which is sad. And the pond scum of the internet is already using this to try to defraud people. There are fake Twitter accounts asking people to send Bitcoin, all this kind of stuff. If you're going to give, and I certainly think that's an appropriate thing to do, make sure you do it through some sort of reputable channel, because there are absolute scumbags out there trying to defraud people of money through this tragedy, which makes me so angry.
Oh, yeah. And whenever speaking I see one of those things, I mean, if it's a, you know, an earthquake or a tsunami or something like that, I go straight, I type in redcross.com, you know, I start there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, particularly for those kind of natural disasters, the Red Cross or Menace on Stone Frontier, you have these highly reputable organizations that have worldwide branches. It's just so straightforward. And actually, Apple make it supremely easy. You go to the iTunes store and it goes, would you like to help?
Yeah.
Yes. Done.
I actually paused on Apple doing it at first, and then now I'm on the program, but I was like, let me wait and see. Is that real? You know, Spidey sense always up.
Well, that's a sign of a very up Spidey sense. But yeah, no, Apple is very real about it. I think, you know, it's a Tim Cook thing, a more socially responsible Apple.
Yeah.
Speaking of cranky making, although obviously different, Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance is continuing his fight to force backdoors into phones because he has all of these phones he can't decrypt and it's terrible. And it's like, yes, but it would be worse if you could decrypt them because then we'd all be less secure. So I can see why, as a law, if your job is to be DA and all you see is your job, then you can myopically miss the point and it's not malice. It's just misguided. So, okay, I don't think he's a bad guy. But I hope he loses this fight.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a new strain of Android malware called Godless. It can root 9 out of 10 Android devices. And it has been found in the Google Play Store. And
so
it silently roots.
What can we do about it?
Get an iPhone.
No, stop it. Really?
Or be one of that 10% of people who is actually up to date, which I think means you have to buy a phone
from
that is
Google,
one of the official Google ones. Yeah, the Nexuses, because they can have the latest and greatest. So this affects all but the very latest version of Android, which I've lost track of which sweetie it is.
Yeah.
Not KitKat, whatever came out, JKL.
Lima Bean? Lollipop.
No, hang on, Lollipop sounds like it's old. I've lost
Marshmallow.
Track.
Maybe around Marshmallow.
Whatever it is. Basically, the one that Apple laughed at because they only had 10% adoption of their shiniest new OS. That's the one you want to be on.
So this keeps you away from the happiness of saying, well, as long as I'm in the Google Play Store, I'm okay.
But that hasn't been the case. Like, every time we report on these stories, and it's been found in the Google Play Store.
Since it's been installed on more than 850,000 devices worldwide. Jeez.
Yes. A few percent in the U.S., but a few percent of hundreds of thousands is still quite a few people.
Yeah, because it's in other stores as well. It's not just in the Google Play Store, so probably in maybe it's in some Asian or Russian ones too.
And I am sure it's in some piratey ones.
Right, right. But usually you tell people believe that if they stay in the Google Play Store, they'll be okay. I assume Google is whack-a-moling those as fast as they can.
Yeah, they just don't seem to be succeeding as well as I'd like. It's definitely the least Wild West of all the possible places to go. Like, it's definitely better than going elsewhere. But it's not... don't just think, it's in the Play Store, it must be fine. It's also a case of looking at who the developer is. If this is a... You know, I mean, there must be Android equivalents of companies like Panic and stuff who have built up a reputation over years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who it is as important as what store it's from, I guess.
Yeah.
At least in the Google store, you're very unlikely to have pirated apps. So that saves you from a whole batter of rubbish, because a pirated app is so likely to contain malware. So, you know, you're definitely better off there than anywhere else.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say, oh, stay away from that place, it's terrible. It's like, no, go there, but be aware that it's not a utopia. And that could be true of the Apple store as well. It's just, so far, Apple have succeeded in not having this kind of thing happen in their store.
There have been a little bit, right?
Yeah, nothing
quite this bad.
Yeah, yeah, to be honest, there's been nothing dramatic. Touch wood. Where's all the wood? It's not the same. Facebook will tell their advertisers when you visit their physical stores, so that they can tell how successful their ads were. If say Walmart show an ad to you, and then you, with your phone with Facebook logged in, go to Walmart, they will tell Walmart that so many thousand people saw their ad and then went to Walmart.
Why is that, Ben?
I cannot imagine anything more creepy than that.
Okay.
It's like tying the fact that you saw an ad and then that you went to a certain physical place and tying that information together and giving it back to the person who bought the ad. Like, ugh.
Has Facebook come back on that one? Because sometimes these things come out and then Facebook explains what they actually did.
Well, for best as I could tell, this is from Naked Security, who have yet to tell me Porky Pies.
Yeah. So how does Facebook know when you went to a physical store?
Because you have the app. You're running the app.
But the app then must have location services turned on?
Mm-hmm. Which I presume a lot of people do, because they want to be able to tweet where they are and all. They can not tweet. Whatever the Facebook word is for that.
Those kids today.
Right. Yeah, this is a new service.
Okay.
Store visit service. Historically, it's been very difficult to quickly and effectively measure the impact of advertising on store visits and in-store sales. With the launch of store visits, a new metric in ads reporting, advertisers can now better understand their store traffic after running local awareness ads, complementing current ads reporting to provide a more complete picture. So I don't think this is made up. This isn't a
bug. This is a feature.
Right. They're touting it. Hmm. They're selling it. I it turns my ick sensor up to like 11.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't have a Facebook account, so I don't mind. Well, I do mind, but okay. It's more reason not to. Google are doing something that you may or may not find useful. They're offering another option for two-factor authentication that may be of less friction to some people.
Hmm.
So they're not taking away the ability to send you the code or to have you use the code generating the little authenticator. Mm-hmm. Style authentication. Those options remain in place for people who prefer them. But they're also having the option that you will run an app on your phone, and when you try to log in, that app will just pop up a message saying, is that you? And will I let you in? And you just say yes, and then in you go.
Well, how is that? Wait, what?
So you're on your Mac,
yeah,
and you go to click into Google, and your phone goes beep,
oh, your
beep.
Phone says it. Okay.
Yeah, and then on the phone, you say, yep, that's me, let me in.
So all it's taking out is this six-digit code?
Right, so instead of sending a code to your phone that you then type into the website, you just do everything on the phone. You just tick, yeah, this is me.
So I've come to peace with two-factor, and you're right, it all did settle down and stopped annoying me, except for I've got one bad example. One I don't know what I'm going to do. My shiny new Chromebook that I made out of a 2008 MacBook, every time I open it up and turn it on, I have to enter my Google password and my authenticator code. And my Google password is nice and long now.
Of course, you can't use one password
yet. Nope. Can't use one password. I think I can't do anything, so I don't think I could even use LastPass for it.
Well, you have two-factor auth on, so maybe you might consider dialing back the harshness of your password.
Yeah, I might need to, because it's like 25 characters and it's got a goat in it and stuff.
You know, as long as you stay over 12
with
and you
two-factor.
Have two-factor auth. But like, that's pretty darn good.
Okay. Thank you for permission, because it's nasty.
Yeah, no, and that is really unpleasant. Like, yeah, it just is unpleasant. So you don't want to be doing that all the time.
And one other thing, you know, the idea of XA PassWD is to give you secure, random, yet memorable passwords. Random doesn't mean that it won't sometimes say something that actually makes sense. There's two words in mind that they go perfectly together, but it's just random.
Yeah, it's random chance does all sorts of funny things.
Yeah.
The last thing I have in important security news is that I forgot to write down which U.S. government agency. Basically, one of the U.S. government agencies fined a company called InMobi a whopping $950,000 for tracking the locations of millions of users without having got proper consent.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty interesting. The company is, it's not a U.S. company, though, right? I think Mobi is Singapore-based, yeah. Which is interesting.
They're obviously using it in the States because the FTC slapped the fine on them.
I wonder if they can get the money out of them. Oh, sorry. Back to All About Me and my password. Do you know why I haven't changed it to be stronger?
I don't know.
Because I will have to enter it 27 times. That's why.
And
right?
Does changing your password invalidate existing authentications? Don't think so.
Oh, maybe not. That's what's been terrifying me. I'm like, oh my God, there's another 4 days of my life gone if I change it ever again.
Well, no, because it's from that point forward your password becomes, but you've used a password to get a token and that token is now on your computer. So I don't think it'll invalidate the existing tokens.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see. You might hear from me.
I'll hear about it, yeah. If it does, I'll hear about it, yeah. I imagine that shouldn't be as painful as you think. We shall see. Lots of news has ended up in the notable breaches section this time around. So the first one is actually a very important one. So DeRay McKeeson is someone famous. I don't actually know this person, but I know that this person is apparently a famous person. They're involved in Black Lives Matter and stuff. And they had their Twitter stolen, even though they had two-factor auth enabled.
Mm-hmm.
How? Well, two-factor auth from Twitter relies on SMS. SMS relies on your carrier not being Muppets. That is not a valid assumption.
Oh, no.
You can wander into an American cell phone carrier store and with a little bit of social engineering, you can become someone else. And this happened to a lady high up in the government recently as well that we also talked about. So you need to do everything you can to add as much authentication as you can to your cell carrier because that is now the weakest point if you're using SMS-based two-factor auth.
Which is why I'm pretty sure everything I've set up.
Yeah, which is why I have at every turn and at every option I have used Google Authenticator, which 1Password is so nice at implementing.
Yeah, I haven't... Okay. I don't want to keep making it all about me, but I haven't been able to get to a point where it ever offers to let me do that. My option always ends up being, and here's, I'm going to send you a text message.
Well, Dropbox will let you do it. You can experiment with your Dropbox.
Okay. I know how to do it. I watched Don McAllister's awesome tutorial that showed me how to do it, and I would love to use it.
I'm using it on at least 5 things at the moment, and I have SMS on only 2.
Okay. Well, Google and Apple, I don't think did.
Well, yeah, but Apple doesn't use SMS. Apple uses iMessage.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, it's just if it's going to your cell phone number, that's the scary one. Going to your Apple ID is better.
Okay.
So, yeah, so the Apple one I wouldn't be nearly as worried about. It's the Twitter one in particular that you have no choice but to just do SMS. Or at least you didn't when I set it up.
Okay.
So, and the real take home here is that whatever services are offered to make it harder to take over your account with your cell carrier, do that because you don't want someone hijacking your phone number.
So that will obviously depend.
Yeah, that will depend on your carrier, and I couldn't possibly give advice for every carrier on the planet, but think of that one as an important one to protect. A German university student succeeded in getting arbitrary code execution on many important servers, including ones ending in .gov and .mil, which are not the kind of places that should be having arbitrary code execution. And he did so simply by publishing booby-trapped versions of common software libraries on the internet in the assumption that developers are lazy sods and they won't actually go to the source. So they'll just Google for jQuery, and instead of getting it from jQuery.com, they'll get it from some randomer. Wow. And hence, they will install backdoors into their own systems. I mean, how anyone can be so stupid and work for the government, I don't understand.
Well, it's not just somebody. He tricked 17,000 separate coders into running this script.
That makes me so sad.
Yeah. But, you know, smart and wise aren't the same thing.
Yep. that is it in a nutshell. Yeah.
I know many wise but not brilliant people and vice versa.
Yeah. So that is just, if you are, like, it is normal not to reinvent the wheel. Not only is it normal, it's a good thing. But when you're getting your wheel, don't get it from some randomer on the internet. Go to the actual place that made the wheel.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons we don't go to places like download.com and unfortunately, yeah, SourceForge anymore.
Right. Yeah, and they're only doing it to annoy us. They're not malicious. They're just...
Well,
peach.
Yeah.
Whatever comes between malicious and annoying.
So, okay.
So I'm just saying, anyone...
All we can say is, huh. Don't be stupid, right?
Very shortly in Programming by Stealth, we're going to be borrowing someone else's wheel, because we're not going to reinvent wheels. Mm. So when we get to that point, I will be reminding you to go and download said wheel from the official source.
From the wheel developer. All right.
The wheel developer, exactly. I don't know how many of our listeners use uTorrent to acquire, shall we say, TV shows and stuff. But if you do, you need to go to
Linux distributions.
Linux distributions, yes, that's it. You're using it for Linux distributions.
I talked over what the warning was, sorry.
They've had their password database breached, so you reset your password. And if you use that password anywhere else, reset it there too.
Okay.
GitHub is the latest victim of these not actually being attacked, but suffering massive account takeovers situation because of password reuse from these massive breaches we've had in the last few weeks. So GitHub are warning that an awful lot of reused passwords are being tried and sometimes succeeding. Now, if you're using GitHub to share out open source code, the absolute last thing you want is for someone who's not you to have access to that, because they then have the power to add anything they'd like to your software, which will then... You are the source, so anyone who comes to the maker of the wheel comes to you, only you've just had your account taken over and had malware shoved into your code. It's going to destroy your reputation, and it's also going to affect everyone who trusts you. So it's actually a really, really important account to protect, which is why I would suggest, if you haven't done so already, A, reset your password, and B, enable two-factor auth.
Ah.
And they do either SMS or Google Authenticator. So they are one of the places that I have an authenticator style two-factor password.
Another vote.
Yes, another vote. And again, because HSXKPassWD is up there, I thought it was very important to make sure my account is protected, which is why it has two-factor auth.
I want to sneak in an ad right here. You just cover your ears, Bart, because I know you get embarrassed when I say this kind of stuff. But Bart has put an awful lot of work into XKPassWD, and I was over there using it the other day when I noticed that he has a PayPal button on that site. And I thought, you know what? Man, I get a lot of use out of this. I use this tool constantly. Even if I'm not going to his website, I've got it embedded as a service on my Mac. And I was talking to Alistair. He's got a great Alfred script that he's written so he can grab XKPassWD passwords. So I pushed that button and I paid him something for it. So maybe if you guys have been using it and enjoying it, you know, go over to xkpasswd.net and push that little PayPal button. Throw Bart some coin for all the work he did on that. Okay, you can listen now, Bart.
I was going to say, and to everyone, and a lot of people, and a lot of Nacella Castaways, in fact, have pushed that button over the years. So I just want to say thank you to all those who have.
Yeah, good.
Which includes you.
And back to our regularly scheduled program.
Okay, so GitHub are one of the people suffering from all of this carry-on. Also suffering from this password reuse is Carbonite. And again, this is another one that you probably really shouldn't be reusing passwords on.
Yeah.
This is like a backup solution for all of your files. Like, why hack your computer when they could just go to the cloud and pull it all down from there?
So again, carry on being reuse of passwords, like the giant MySpace breach.
Exactly. So all of these literally hundreds of millions of passwords, of username and password combinations, are now out there, and they're just being tried. And so they've been tried on GitHub. They've been tried in Carbonite. We talked last week about them being tried on Twitter. Lots of places are experiencing these kind of, and Dropbox, And initially, media reports are saying, "Oh, it looks like Dropbox has been breached." And then it's like, no, it's just people reusing these passwords, just trying these passwords.
Yeah.
So in a similar vein, now, actually, I don't have an update in the show notes, but since the story I have in the show notes, a little bit more information about it. So GoToMyPC is resetting everyone's passwords for what they call a very sophisticated hack and proceed not to give any more details. And then a few days later, I heard on Security Now, which I was listening to today, they came back and said, actually, no, it's a password reuse attack.
Very sophisticated attack.
Very sophisticated. But this is what large corporations do, right? They say, oh, sugar, I guess we have to release we've been hacked. And then they throw in this absolute nonsense, very sophisticated. If you ever see that, it means that a PR person wrote it and it means nothing. Nothing whatsoever at all.
It tries to make you think, oh, well, we did every single thing possible, but these guys are so smart. It's like,
yeah,
I would have said, yeah, not my fault. Not my fault. Not my bad. Didn't do it. You guys reuse your passwords.
Yeah. So anyway, again, this is just right. If you reuse, if the message hasn't sunk in yet that you really should have a separate password for everything you do and a password manager to make that humanly feasible, I think the last three security bits probably should have done it for you.
Yeah.
Next. Okay. So this is all still in notable breaches. This next one is just bad news every which way around. An IS hacker has admitted to stealing the personally identifiable information on US service members, passing that information on to terrorists whom he knew would use it to attempt to kill them. Now he's in deep, deep trouble. This has all come out in court.
What does IS stand for?
IS, ISIL, security? ISIS, no, whatever, oh. Whatever this week we're calling those terrorists over there. Okay. Islamic State, in ISIL.
That gives him too much credit. I don't like calling them that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what to call them. Daesh, whatever, those guys.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, this particular hacker chap is saying all of this in court, so that gives you a good idea of how caught he is. But nonetheless, that is not good news for the families of US service members. Like that's scary, scary stuff. And then finally, in case Americans were not upset enough with all these breaches, 154 million US voter records have been exposed. Now these are not just the where you live and whether or not you're allowed to vote records. These are obviously records that have come out of some sort of political campaign or some sort of company that gathers up this data to sell to political campaigns, because it doesn't just include who you are and where you live, but what your Facebook account is, what your party affiliation is, whether or not you own a gun, what your views are on controversial topics like gay marriage, etc. In other words, this is the kind of data that political campaigns use to target people. And 154 million of those records have just escaped because someone forgot to put a password on a database.
Really?
I'm kind of cranky that the Naked Security story doesn't mention the name of the company that did this blunder, because I would quite like to name check them.
Yeah.
But the story doesn't say, so I can't say.
Huh.
Okay, so...
Wait. On Tuesday, Vickery reached out to the company, a data brokerage firm named L2.
Yeah, so they say that it's one of their customers who breached it.
Oh, I got you. Got you.
So L2 sold the data to someone who then forgot to put a password on it.
I'm closing that window. I'm not going to look at that. That's just too creepy.
But the good news is there's a lot more than 154 million Americans, so it's not guaranteed that you're on it. I'm not sure that counts as good news. But.
You're really reaching.
Okay, suggested reading. So the first one here I have is Explanations of Differential Privacy, and I have two links in the show notes, one to Wired and one to a cryptographer's blog. But I will give you a brief summary. So differential privacy is not a marketing term.
Explain for this is what Apple announced at WWDC about how they're going to increase our privacy.
Right. So it's not right. The aim is okay. So
not increase our privacy.
Not increase our privacy. Keep our privacy protected while still having the ability to crowdsource.
Right.
So Apple want the ability to learn from how we use our devices in such a way that they don't compromise our privacy, and that's not straightforward to do, but not actually impossible. So differential privacy is sort of a blanket. It's a broad term for a group of techniques that have the same aim. And if something is meeting that aim, then the way you can tell it is that a data set with your data in it and a data set without your data in it is not noticeably different.
Right.
So no individual person's data makes a notable difference in the whole, which is exactly what you want, because otherwise it would have too much information about you if you could tell the difference.
Right.
So if you could imagine, if you could see the ballots one by one being voted in an election, and then you could see someone walk into a polling booth and you could see the new total and it went from 11 for one candidate to 12. It's like, ah, I know who you voted for because I could, you know, your piece of data made all the difference. I can now tell how you voted. That would be not differential privacy. So there's a whole bunch of techniques for doing this. It's a goal rather than a specific algorithm. But one of the, a lot, the techniques revolve around the same sort of idea that if you have enough people, you can actually make the data noisy and still get the signal back later. So what, whenever your computer is reporting something, it will toss a virtual coin and decide whether or not to lie. So randomly, everything you're sending back is 50-50 or 75-25. I mean, the exact numbers vary. But basically, when your computer goes to send something up to the cloud, it tosses an imaginary coin and decides whether to tell absolute porcupines or whether to tell the truth. And all of those porcupines will average out because you're going to randomly rely with garbage. So when you have a set of a million people, the garbage cancels out and what's left is the signal.
Okay.
But you can never tell what Allison thought because there's a 50-50 chance that whatever came from Allison was a complete porcupine.
Okay.
So you are, firstly, Apple will anonymize the data, but even if you manage to de-anonymize it, it still tells you nothing because there's a 50-50 chance it's absolutely made up.
So now, what I understand from reading the cryptography blog, which you've linked to, a fantastic mm-hmm. article because it's got a fair amount of mathy words in it, but it's still readable. Is that the more noise, like the coin flip, mm-hmm. the lying part, the more noise they add to it, the less likely they are able to see something about you individually, but mm-hmm. the less accurate the data becomes. And
yes.
there was a, if you don't mind, I'd like to read the one paragraph that went with the graph that talked about the illnesses. Mm-hmm. They said to give an absolutely crazy example of how these trade-offs work and how big they can be. The authors of this paper started with a public database linking warfarin dosage outcomes to specific genetic markers. Then they
warfarin,
used,
by the way,
warfarin. Sorry,
it's a very, very common drug around these parts.
Okay. They then used machine learning techniques to develop a dosing model based on their database, but they applied differential privacy at various privacy budgets, which is how much noise you're going to add. While training the model, then they evaluated both the information leakage and the model's success at treating these virtual patients. The results showed that the model's accuracy depends on the privacy budget. If it's set too high, the database leaks a great deal of sensitive patient information. On the other hand, when the budget was reduced to a level that achieved meaningful privacy, the noise-ridden model had a tendency to kill the virtual patients. So yes. You got to find that sweet spot.
Right. I mean, this is real computer science, right? This is an active area of ongoing research. This is not just something you tick a box and it's done. But since we're reading from this blog by Matthew Green, I'm going to finish up with his final thoughts, his closing paragraph. Maybe this is all too inside baseball. At the end of the day, it sure looks like Apple is honestly trying to do something to improve user privacy. And given the alternatives, maybe that's more important than anything else.
Yeah. I think it's an excellent thing that they're trying to do. And it is very different from the Google model, where you give everything to them so that they can mine the data more accurately. Mm-hmm. But didn't he also say that Google was using one of these algorithms in something it's doing? I think there was a bit towards the beginning where he talked about...
I'm sure they are using it in some of their stuff. I think I remember reading that too. I don't remember what it was though.
And
the other thing we should say, it wasn't clear from the keynote, but it has become clear since Recode were reporting on this. Even this level of sharing, so this 50-50 chance of lying level of sharing, is opt-in.
Ah, good point. So if you want to be able to have your photos... able to see that this is a mountain, Lake Shasta, then you
No, not even at that level. Because basically Apple learn from everyone who does opt in, and they don't keep the results a secret. They don't keep the algorithms they develop a secret. So your iPhone will know what a mountain is based on a whole bunch of servers Apple have had cranking away at this for ages to come up with the algorithm. And anyone who opts in to this will add to that algorithm and make it smarter, but everyone gets the benefit. So it's not even that they're saying, if you don't share with us, we'll tell you nothing. You still get some told stuff.
Okay, so I don't let my photos, I don't let it give the information from my phone up, but I still get the help that you have uploaded yours.
Yes.
Okay. All right. One last question, and maybe this is too deep, but one of the things I was reading about differential privacy said that there's a number of queries you can make against a database before you have lowered the noise level such that you can no longer use that database.
Yes. So you have noise coming in, and when you're querying it, you're distilling noise out of it again. So you always have to have a budget to keep track of how noisy it is.
But how does pulling data out of it reduce the noise level? The noise level's still there.
You've gone too far.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the piece in my head. If you ever crack the code on that, that would be interesting. Maybe we got to take a couple more math classes to learn that one.
We do. And this is some serious cryptography. Like the basically, Apple are going to have to monitor this data so that they can make sure it remains appropriately noisy. And they're going to have to be careful how they use the results to make sure that they don't read too much into them. So they're not going to be using it to treat people with warfarin, which is a good thing. You know, if they start calling horses cows, it's a bit funny, but it's not the end of the world. And that is sort of the worst case scenario here.
Ah, right. Adding a certain level of noise is going to be, that'll still be okay.
Yeah. So I think the fact that Apple are trying to do this impresses me a lot.
Yeah.
Because it means that they're not just saying, oh, well, we give up. We respect privacy, therefore we shall not offer any useful services. No, let's have our cake and eat it. I very much applaud this approach.
Very cool. Well, I think that's awesome. Do we have any other highlights and suggested reading, or are we good to go?
I do have a few other things I want to suggest to you. So the first, we've talked about the first. The second is this year, they may have done it last year too, but they definitely did it this year. The WWDC sessions are all streamable, not just the keynote. They're all streamable. And so there was one entitled, there's one about how Apple makes iOS and macOS more secure. So in other words, it's a high-level overview of what they're doing to secure their platforms. I think it's a half-hour talk, and it doesn't go into nerdy detail. It is an overview. It's an executive summary of what they're doing and why. And I think a lot of our listeners would enjoy watching that. I certainly got a lot out of it.
I just clicked add to reading list. I plan to play it during breakfast this morning.
Excellent. Then there's a link to an article. Oh, what does it say? Medium.com. I could have sworn that came from Naked Security. Yes. This article is from Medium, and it warns people about sharing certain types of links on Facebook, because no matter what privacy setting you put on a link, it is not private. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're linking to a news article, that's not an issue. But if you're linking to a document in your OneDrive or a document in your Office 365 or whatever, where basically the link is the password, so the link contains a whole bunch of random garbage and the link lets people in, well, Facebook, the way Facebook's database works, no matter what privacy setting you set on that, that is not private data.
Interesting.
And that is very dangerous for these kind of services that use the URL as a password. And so the article is titled Why You Shouldn't Share Links on Facebook.
Yeah, that's kind of link baity, but I can see what they're saying, where if you've got a document stored in Google Drive that has your company passwords in plain text and then you link to that.
Yeah, I mean, whatever, the document could simply be some recon on your competitors that you really don't want to get out. Like, it's anything that may be in any way sensitive at all, if you put that link onto Facebook, bear in mind that any randomer on the planet can effectively click that link.
Right.
It's interesting. And it's to do with how they've designed their database. And I would argue it's a very bad design. But how do you retrofit something used by a kabillion people?
Yeah. But you can safely put other kinds of links out there.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a link to an article on The Onion, well, that's not a secret. Unless you don't want people to know you read The Onion. But why wouldn't you?
Why would you put private links on Facebook? Anyway.
Because you send a private message to someone. Right? You're thinking private, 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 private. But no, links are never private.
I just can't imagine.
They're not available in the GUI. They're available through the API.
Right. But I'm just saying I just have trouble imagining using Facebook Messenger to send private information. It wouldn't have occurred to me to do that in the first place.
You were in a minority.
Yeah, that's true. All right.
And then the last one I want to draw a line under is from Naked Security, which is the one I thought the other one was, which is 3 ways to better secure your Facebook account.
Good.
So there we go. So that does us for this week. There are other stories in there, but I will leave them to people to read of their own account.
All right. Well, this was a fairly depressing episode of Security Bits. Really enjoyed it, Bart.
Oh, come on. We ended on differential privacy. That's a good news story.
We did. Yay. That is good. No. That's a nice story. We should always try to wind up with something that doesn't want to make us want to kill ourselves.
I think so. I certainly try to do that. Okay. Well, until next time, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allison@podfeet.com or follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Don't forget to check out those Google Plus community at podfeet.com/Google Plus and podfeet.com/Facebook for the Facebook group. You know those are both great places to go. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, we had a blast this week. It was a small crowd, but very, very enthusiastic. And I think I will have a live show on July 3rd. I'm going to have family over, but I think I'll sneak off and do a live show. But just in case, keep an eye on Twitter and other resources to find out whether I'm actually doing it or not. But if I am, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.